You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
That jerk who cut you off this morning and stole your parking spot.
Thou hast revenged our ruin, walking a straight way before our God.
We dream of getting even, mostly.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, we'll hear about Charles Mingus getting back at everybody.
He wanted to actually beat Eric up because Eric was going to quit. He wanted to fight him. He wanted to cut him with a knife.
And the Renaissance artist Artemisia Gentileschi paints a heroine with some muscle.
There's something quite different about that representation from Caravaggio's, and I think that the difference lies in the sense of the women's arms.
My guest is the journalist Laura Blumenfeld, the author of Revenge, A Story of Hope. That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. Sometimes being the parent of adolescents jibes nicely with being a professional cultural observer. What I mean is this. I've been thinking a lot lately about what rock bands and pop musicians choose to call themselves, the morphology and the shifting fashions of their stage names. Lots of bands today still pursue the plain vanilla 60s MO, a plural noun with a definite article. Back then, there were the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Monkees. Today, there's the Beastie Boys and the Hives and the White Stripes. Then there's the singular noun without any article. Creed and Offspring these days. Cream and Blind Faith back then. But I've noticed that several leading examples of today's hippest nomenclature barely existed when I was young. Like willfully quirky three-word names. In the 60s and 70s, only a very few bands went this route, and they were all faintly ridiculous and a little cheesy. Put your hands on your head. I'm thinking of the bubblegum band The 1910 Fruit Gum Company and Three Dog Night, The Strawberry Alarm Clock, and Grand Funk Railroad. Starting in the last decade, though, almost all the bands with willfully quirky three- and four-word names were actually kind of cool, like Rage Against the Machine, Toad the Wet Sprocket, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and the Stone Temple Pilots. And today, there are suddenly lots of cool bands with quirky, grammatically elaborate names, and this is the new 21st century thing, names with verbs in them. I'm talking about bands like Badly Drawn Boy, OK Go, Breaking Benjamin, and Jimmy Eat World. Something like the same evolution has occurred with performers who go by one name. Back in the 1960s, I was aware of only two singers who went by a single name. Dion.
Why must I be a teenager in love?
And Fabian. Both Italian-American, both cheesy, both second or third rank. But then, over time, and especially after they were dead, the biggest iconic pop superstars of all became known by just their given names, Elvis and Marilyn. Then, in the 80s, a couple of would-be pop superstars decided to accelerate that process, to will themselves to become icons. Thus, Madonna and Prince. So now, practically every solo performer, aside from folk singers, goes by just a single synthetic name. There's Nelly and Nas, Pink and Ashanti and Shakira, Beck and Moby, and, of course, Eminem. The third new form of pop naming fashion combines trend number one with trend number two. These are names that are willfully quirky and linguistically imaginative and consist of just one concocted word. It started in the 90s with the Seattle grunge band Soundgarden. Now, almost every hard rock band of a certain bent has a pseudo-Germanic one-word name. Nickelback, Pin Monkey, Hoobastank, Sugar Cult, Lifehouse, Fisher Spooner, Audio Slave, and Coldplay. There's yet another new naming fad that I talked about on the show a year ago. I mean the ones consisting of a noun followed by a numeral, like Blink 182, Matchbox 20, Eve 6, and Sum 41. And for that matter, I guess, like Studio 360. This is Kurt Anderson. Today in Design for the Real World, graphic designer Stephen Heller stares into store windows and confesses his passion for mannequins.
My love of mannequins is because they are ideal. You only see mannequins designed to present the most beautiful aspects of humankind. It makes them totally unrealistic, but at the same time you can dream and you can fantasize. And the way mannequins are dressed, the way they're positioned, they take on lives of their own. And I think that that's why they are so compelling in a store window. The mannequin comes from France, actually. They were sculpted often in wax and made very beautifully detailed with real glass eyes and perhaps real hair. Gorgeous pieces. And while they made them in multiples, the faces were often unique. And there were, in the 30s and 40s, artisans who used real actors and actresses and were known for that kind of theatrical model, as it was called. And those faces would be the styles, the models of the year. And those new additions would be hyped. You know, these are the people, Ava or Greta or Clark, often movie star names, that would sell your products. The sad thing about the design of mannequins today is this idea of modernism, that to be modern, you have to take away the physical attributes. You have to take away the character. You have to make everything somewhat universal. Many of the stores, many of the key retailers today don't have faces on their mannequins. They just have little round ball-like heads. The clothes become the focal point as opposed to the character of the mannequin. My favorite mannequins, the ones that I will stare at, and when I'm riding by a department store on a bus, I'll look for it, or if I'm walking by, I'll stop, are really the classic models, the beautiful women who are draped in wonderful clothes and whose eyes tend to stare out vacantly, but I know they're staring out vacantly at me.
That sly come hither stare that strips my conscience bare, it's witchcraft.
Stephen Heller is a graphic designer who has published more than 70 books about design. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it's time now for this week's cover story. If there were no such thing as revenge, a large chunk of the movies that you like would disappear. The same with theater or opera, pop music, novels. The desire, even the need to get back at someone isn't nice, but it is part of being human. And revenge is more than blood feuds and plotting your enemy's demise. It motivates some people to create, even to create beauty. My guest today is Laura Blumenfeld. She's the author of the book Revenge, A Story of Hope. Laura, your story begins with your father being shot in Jerusalem in 1986. Tell me that story.
Well, I was a college student at the time, and I got a phone call from my father saying, "Honey, I just want you to know you're going to see something on the news, but I'm okay." He was just on a week trip to Jerusalem. He was there as a tourist, and he was walking home through the souvenir market when a gunman stepped out of an alley, raised a gun to my father's head and shot him. The first reports were that he'd been killed because there was a death gang operating at the time, shooting foreign tourists, German, British, American. And some of the people were killed, and he wanted to make sure that I found out that he was alive.
And a death gang, these were Palestinians motivated by some kind of ideological zeal?
They were backed by Syria. It was a quiet time in Jerusalem, which is hard to believe. People could walk the streets without fear, and they got this idea, let's kill some foreigners and see if we can scare people away.
And was your father chosen at random?
It was random, yes. There was no connection really between the victims. One German woman was on a Church Holy Land tour. A British pilgrim was just visiting the holy sites. He was a born-again Christian.
And your father is a rabbi?
My father's a rabbi.
But the shooter didn't know that?
No, he didn't. In fact, in his confession, he said he saw a man wearing a suit and he just aimed at his nose and pulled the trigger.
How were the next hours and days? How did you react to this new fact in your life?
It really shook me up. I was young. I was getting ready to step out into the world, and I suddenly wondered what was this world I was stepping into. I felt like I needed to track that bullet down to its source and find the person and somehow shake him up. One fantasy was just a straightforward Sylvester Stallone, I want to grab him and whack him around and don't you hurt my family. It was this kind of visceral rage you feel against anyone who hurts your child or your sibling or a parent. The other part of me had an even more unrealistic goal, which was to somehow reach down inside of him and shake up his soul.
So how did you move from this moment and these various unrealistically violent, unrealistically turn-the-other-cheek fantasies to the hunt for the shooter?
Well, I became a journalist. That toughened me up a bit, and I just saw more and more examples of revenge around the world. And I just thought, you know, I have these irrational fantasies. So does half the world, and it accounts for more than half of the turmoil in the world. And I just decided to try to go out there and break revenge down, to unravel revenge as a journalist and also as a person who'd like to follow through on her own dark thoughts. And I began to travel the world, speak with other avengers, see what they had to offer, what kind of wisdom and methods they used. And then I also pursued the man who tried to kill my father.
And how does one do this? This began some years after the fact, did it not?
That's right. I dug around in police files and newspaper archives, and I found a list of 25 men who had been rounded up at the time for the killings of these and shootings of various tourists, and just ticked down the list. I didn't have phone numbers or addresses or anything other than names. So I took the bus from Jerusalem on the road to Ramallah, which is hard to believe these days because you need to be in a bulletproof van or a tank, and wandered and knocked on doors until I found the right home.
You arrive at the shooter's family's home in the West Bank, and they immediately open their door to you.
That's right. His mother welcomed me with a glass of orange soda and asked me to sit down. I asked where her son was. I had introduced myself simply as Laura. I'm a journalist writing about revenge. And she said, he's not here. He tried to kill a man. And then I asked, well, who? I wasn't sure, really, if I had found the right home. And the young boy sitting next to me shrugged and said, some Jew. And they started to laugh. And then they described this American walking through the souvenir market, and their son shot him in the head. And it just began to dawn on me that they were describing my father. They were laughing about it. They said it was public relations. It was a way to get people to look at us.
And what then ensued was practically as implausible as anything in one of those Shakespearean plays. You began corresponding with and actually met the guy who shot your father.
That's right. We smuggled letters back and forth. And he started out describing my father in completely inhuman terms. He talked about him as a, quote, chosen military target. And I kept thinking, is that a radar station? Is that even a human being? What is he talking about? Over time, though, I, again, had introduced myself to him as a reporter, so I told him I interviewed this David Blumenfeld, and I can tell you he's not a military target. He's not an Israeli. He's an American, and he was visiting Jerusalem for a week. And, in fact, he has quite a good understanding of your cause, and he feels like, you know, that you deserve something, but violence is not the way to get that. So over time, I was trying, although it was very, very unrealistic, I was trying to see if I could get the gunman to see my father in human terms.
Now, finally, in the what I find to be the most implausible, if you tried it in fiction, they'd throw you out scene, you attended his parole hearing in Israel.
That's right. This was the first time I was coming face to face with him. And I agree with you, by the way. If there weren't a court transcript, I would wonder myself what went on in that room.
Tell me exactly what happened. At this point, he still didn't know who you were. He just thought you were Laura, the journalist who was interested in this case.
That's right. He didn't know who I was, and his family who was attending the hearing didn't know who I was. I only spoke English or Arabic with them. I never spoke Hebrew, although I'm fluent in Hebrew, because I didn't want them to know that I was Jewish, and they didn't. But I decided it was time to stand up and declare myself for who I was and what I believed in. And he was very, very sick with asthma, and there was a medical report saying that if he stayed in prison, he could possibly die, that it endangered his life. And the hearing was about that, whether he should be released or not. So I argued my way up to the front of the courtroom. There were three judges. They looked down at me and they said, okay, you can speak in English, young lady. And I said, no, I'd like to speak in Hebrew. And at that moment, the gunman jumped up and he was terrified. Who is this person? She's not who she appears to be. And they made him sit down and with his ankle chains were clanking. And I introduced myself simply as Laura. And I said that I come from the United States. I don't know all the facts of this case, but I've come to know the family and through the family, the gunman. And I think that he's truly sorry for what he did. And he's made a promise, which he had made a promise to me in letters, never to hurt anybody for his beliefs, never to go back to any acts of violence. And I said, also, I've come to know the victim, David Blumenfeld. And David Blumenfeld feels that if he's truly repentant and truly sick, he should go home to his family, that 12 years of prison is enough. And at that point, the judges just went wild. They said, who are you to say? You have no right to speak on behalf of the victim. The prosecuting attorney also said this is classic hearsay. This breaks all the rules of evidence. Lots of screaming back and forth. I kept insisting, I do have a right to speak. I do have a right to speak. And they said, why? And finally I said, because I'm his daughter. The courtroom went completely quiet. And I said, Laura Blumenfeld. And behind me I heard a woman crying and then just sobbing kind of rolled through the courtroom. I turned around, though, and looked at the gunman for the first time, and I locked eyes with him. And it wasn't a friendly look I gave him. It was hard and unforgiving. And I said to him, and you promised me on your honor that you would never hurt anybody again. And this is your vow. This is a pact now between the Blumenfeld family and the Khatib family, your family. He couldn't even speak. He just sat there flabbergasted. But I did get my revenge in the end. He wrote me a letter and said, you made me feel so stupid, forever causing you any pain. Sorry. More important, he wrote my father a letter. And he said to my father, Laura was the mirror that made me see your face as a human being, deserved to be admired and respected. And I apologize for missing her message from the beginning. That was a sweet kind of revenge, because when he pulled the trigger, he denied my father's humanity and I think that I was able to shame him and also restore that humanity. That was my revenge.
The writer Laura Blumenfeld is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. In a minute, we'll hear about a 17th century painting that was itself an act of revenge. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. My guest today is the writer Laura Blumenfeld. We're discussing art about revenge and art that exacts revenge. One of the earliest legends of revenge is the biblical story of Judith cutting off the head of Holofernes. There are lots of artistic spins on this tale of the female avenger. Judith Kempfner looks at the story and two paintings that tried to bring it to life.
You could call Judith a magnificent beheader. Vivaldi wrote an oratorio about her, which sticks closely to the biblical description of her adventure. Judith is a rich and beautiful young widow, a symbol of virtue. Her people, the Israelites, are besieged by an Assyrian army of 10,000 only because they refuse to join a war. After 34 days, the siege takes its toll. In a vinyl recording of the 50s, the classical actress Judith Anderson reads from the biblical text.
And the cisterns were emptied, and they had not water to drink their fill for one day. Therefore their young children were out of heart, and their women and young men fainted for thirst, and fell down in the streets of the city, and by the passages of the gates, and there was no longer any strength in them.
And then Judith takes the initiative. She tells the elders that the suffering has gone too far, that it's time for vengeance. She walks straight into the invaders' camp, promising to offer classified information, lures the Assyrian general Holofernes into a drunken slumber, and hacks off his head. The enemy retreat, and Judith has saved her people.
Then all the people were wonderfully astonished and bowed themselves and worshipped God.
And her people said to her in chorus,
"Thou hast revenged our ruin, walking a straight way before our God."
According to the Bible, Judith tantalizes Holofernes, but is not defiled by him. However, some artists have taken the liberty of fantasizing about her. They have her as a rampant seductress, naked and sitting on the head, or dressed as a high-class prostitute. Other versions are almost comical. She presents an unbloodied, doll-like head to a bunch of angels or shoves a huge bearded neck into a tiny drawstring purse. But some paintings of Judith, stunning for their realism, are by a teacher and his pupil. The Baroque Italian master Caravaggio greatly inspired Artemisia Gentileschi. She's now, by the way, very much in vogue, with a recent exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and two recent historical novels about her life. Both artists were fascinated with the violence of Judith's revenge. In Caravaggio's painting, the pillow is blood-soaked.
Caravaggio seems to have set a really unfortunate trend of spurting blood that was picked up by a number of his followers, including Artemisia Gentileschi.
Larry Silver is a professor of art history at the University of Pennsylvania. In the picture he's looking at, it's obvious that the artist is horrified at the thought of a fragile woman slaying a virile soldier.
This is a kind of mission from God, to use the term of the Blues Brothers movie. And in Caravaggio, she is demure, with a very delicate dress and with very fine features and with no seeming agitation or stress of her body at all. She, in fact, seems to extend her arms away from her body to actually do what she needs to do, instead of having to use her hips, use her legs, or get any leverage of any kind.
It's as if the artist could paint the real experience for the victim of this murder. The expression in Holofernes' rolling eye seems to be witnessing his own death. But what Caravaggio just could not bring himself to do was to show Judith as a real killer. Her sword looks like an egg beater. But it is a gruesome picture because all eyes are on the head. Judith is accompanied by her maid Abra. In the Vivaldi oratorio, Abra is impressed and scared. Oh, miracle, the fearful monster's head you have hewn off. With one blow you have conquered all. Let us go quickly. In the Caravaggio painting, the maid is an old crone, a foil for Judith's youthful purity. But when Artemisia Gentileschi came to paint the same moment in the story,
there's a quality of conspiracy and stealth and shared risk on the part of these two women of different classes.
The two women really are at work. I think it's in that painting that you see the work, if you like, of decapitating.
Mary Jacobus teaches English at Cambridge University.
And now I think it's not the drama of Holofernes' last moments, but the work of the women. And I think in their busy forearms and in the curious way in which his head seems to be emerging from between what could be almost be thighs, and the two women look like midwives hard at work with their huge arms giving birth to this head. And yet there's something quite different about that representation from Caravaggio's, and I think that the difference lies in the sense of the women's arms and the power in those arms.
Two pairs of stocky butcher's arms. The sleeves are rolled back and the muscles are working hard. The blood is spurting out of Holofernes' neck. Both women look determined but unemotional. They have to get on with the job. At the Metropolitan Artemisia exhibition, there were two paintings called Judith Beheading Holofernes. The same composition, only in the second version, the women wear more lavish clothes and the blood flow only increases. The story of Artemisia Gentileschi's life is shadowy, but
one of the things that we know about her is that she was raped as a young woman in the studio of her father by a fellow apprentice. And many people who have studied her have sometimes wanted to see her fascination, her ongoing fascination with Judith, as a kind of woman avenger, as a form of compensation for the trauma and the abuse that she suffered, not only in the rape itself, but in the subsequent trial, which was unsympathetic to her and very unpunitive towards the male.
During the 8-month trial in a papal court, Artemisia refused to deny that she was raped, even under torture. She obsessively returned to the story of Judith, painting it at points before and after the beheading, though the depictions of the deed itself are her signature work. That last Artemisia retrospective at the Met compared her work not only to Caravaggio, but to that of her father, Orazio. There were two of his Judith paintings on display. As expected, they represent Judith and her maidservant after the decapitation. The result? Much less bloody and much less dramatic. And the model for Orazio's Judith? His daughter, Artemisia. For Studio 360, I'm Judith Kampfner.
This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. I'm talking today with Laura Blumenfeld. Laura, did you feel any kindred spirit to Artemisia or to Judith as you were contemplating your various forms of revenge over the last decade?
One thing I think that's interesting is they talk about the sense of power in this Artemisia painting, that the arms were muscular. That really struck me, too, and that's a very important thread for anybody who seeks revenge. They're trying to reverse the balance of power. The weak become strong, the strong become weak, and Artemisia, who painted Judith, who had been raped, and yet she was painting a woman standing over a man in a bed with a sword, which of course can be a phallic symbol, and you can see how she was able to reverse that balance of power through her art.
If Artemisia did indeed paint this and was obsessed with this picture as she was working out her own trauma, do you feel as though that's a legitimate fuel for art?
Absolutely. I think it's a very constructive use of rage. You know, there's this thing called displaced vengeance where you can't get back at the person who hurt you, so you take it out in some other form. And I do think that perhaps she was able to artistically displace her feelings of revenge. I interviewed a psychologist. I asked him, is there any substitute for revenge? And he said the only substitute for revenge is acknowledgement. That's often the emotional goal for vengeance, even more than hurting the person who hurt you, is to have hopefully the perpetrator, and if not, somebody else acknowledge the legitimacy of your pain. And when you're an artist, I think that you do get that kind of acknowledgement, maybe not directly. Of course, people weren't directly responding to her rape, but they were giving her some kind of public acknowledgement of the legitimacy of her themes and her work.
Which you certainly got in your own story. You got that exactly that acknowledgement.
Absolutely. And it's in a way, it's what I was running after the whole time.
Laura Blumenfeld is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. On its surface, the world of children's books seems pretty innocent of all these issues. But lots of fairy tales are really just revenge fantasies packaged for little kids. Think about it. After Little Red Riding Hood was saved from being eaten by the wolf was chopped into bits. Or Hansel and Gretel. They didn't just escape. They and we took pleasure in stuffing her into the oven and incinerating her. So we visited children's book historian Leonard Marcus and the owner of a children's bookstore in San Jose, California, Valerie Lewis, to find out just what kids make of these stories.
Let's go look at some things on the shelf. Oh, my gosh. You know?
This one, Enemy Pie by Derek Munson, came out a couple of years ago. I didn't like Jeremy Ross. He laughed at me when he struck me out in baseball game. He had a party on his trampoline, and I wasn't even invited, but my best friend Stanley was. Jeremy Ross was the one and only person on my enemy list. And then Dad understood stuff like enemies. He told me that when he was my age, he had enemies too, but he knew of a good way to get rid of them, and I asked him to tell me how. Enemy pie. And then there's the Bootsy Barker Bites.
Harriet the Spy.
My mother got married in other disasters.
Oh, how about The Girls Against the Boys and that whole series by Naylor?
Oh, that's right.
The girls get revenge and that whole...
That's right.
Children's books of recent times have talked about revenge much more than in the past. Probably in the early days of modern children's books, going back to the turn of the century, it was almost a taboo subject among the writers who were contemporary then.
Revenge has a certain, there's an element about revenge that is evil.
One of the main ways that revenge did come up in the past in children's books was in the traditional tales, the folk tales and fairy tales.
Magic mirror on the wall, who is the fairest one of all?
In Snow White, the revenge motive is attributed to the villain of the piece, the Wicked Queen. And in the original retelling of Snow White that we know from the Brothers Grimm, at the very end, the queen shows up at Snow White's wedding and is made to put on red-hot slippers and dance herself to death.
I will start when I talk to a group of parents and say, how many of you survived Hansel and Gretel? Now, I always think that when we talk about the good old days, you know, we talk about what's appropriate for children. I look at that and I think, there I was as a frightened kid. I mean, I used to have nightmares. I used to worry and worry and worry about so many things. Hansel and Gretel never worried about that. And it was because I was thinking about those two kids. No matter what happened to them, they survived.
Have you guys ever read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
Yeah.
The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis was published in 1950.
How old were you when you read it?
I was about 5, right?
About 6 or 7.
When my mom read it to me.
And it tells the story of 4 children, 2 brothers and 2 sisters, who manage to pass through a wardrobe, a sort of standing closet in the house where they're staying, and end up in another world, another realm.
One of my favorite characters was Edmund.
Edmund, one of the 4 children, the second youngest, is one of the first 2 children to pass through. But he's criticized by his older brother.
Peter calls him a beast.
And that causes him to want retribution from the brother.
Why do you think Edmund felt like he needed to get back at his brother?
When usually most kids, when someone calls them a bad name or something like that, they feel kind of bad towards them and they want to get back at them, like maybe right away they call them a bad name or think of something bad to do to them.
Have you ever had that happen to you?
Yeah.
Kids are seeing things on television. They're confronted with evil in terms of real life. It seems to me that they're confronted with them early.
All children do experience fear and feelings of rage. It's pointless to pretend that that doesn't exist.
It was a long time ago in elementary school. Someone called me stupid, and I'm like, yeah, right. Since you called me stupid, so are you then. And I still remember that because I didn't really have a good relationship with them.
It's such disturbing material that it was the very kind of topic that children's literature was created to avoid. I mean, it was very dramatic for the children's book world in 1976 when Bruno Bettelheim, a psychoanalyst, won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Uses of Enchantment, which was a discussion of fairy tales from a psychological point of view, from a therapeutic point of view. So here's what he says. If it is objected that thoughts of revenge are immoral and the child should not have any such thoughts, it should be stressed that the idea that one should not have certain fantasies has never stopped people from having them, but only banished them into the unconscious, where the resulting havoc to the mental life is much greater. That's really Bettelheim in a nutshell. The feelings are there, and the question is, what do you do with them?
Children tell us a lot in the books that they choose. And it's so hard not to fight it. I mean, me too, I'll think, what are you reading that for? And very often they just know exactly why they're reading. They can't articulate it, but we have to stop and think about what they're seeing in that picture, and that our perspective isn't exactly the right one, or the same. It might be the right one for us, but it's not the same one for them.
It's hard to say just what children's literature's responsibility is in terms of teaching values, but it's been found over the years that when a children's author tries too hard to teach anything to a child through a book, that the message doesn't come across. And very often, children's books have been forgotten for that very reason, books that were well-meaning. I think we've come to feel in recent years that children have a right to know the range of behaviors that they're likely to experience in the world, and sometimes dark, difficult, menacing behavior can be part of that.
That was children's book historian and critic Leonard Marcus. He was joined by Valerie Lewis, who is the owner of Hickleby's Bookstore in San Jose, as well as John, Ann, and Chris Palowich of Pleasanton, California. Our segment was produced by Jonathan Mitchell. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the writer Laura Blumenfeld, and we're talking about various kinds of revenge. Laura, why do you think it is that revenge as an idea, as an impulse, shows up in children's books so much? Is it a childish impulse?
It is, in fact. Revenge is immature, and only children are animated by this absolute sense of justice. I mean, you hear in every classroom, but it's not fair in every home. It's not fair. Oh, he got it. Why can't I? In fact, Piaget found in his research that as children age from 6 to 12, the impulse towards vengeance decreases as they develop a more sophisticated understanding of justice in the world.
They brought up in that piece, I think, very intelligently, the idea that it's hard to teach anything, including correct behavior or moral behavior through art, through children's literature. Do you believe that, or do you think that we can model behavior effectively through the books that we read or that we have our children read?
I think stories do have an impact on behavior. I know literally the bedtime stories my father told me guided me in some ways through my own revenge journey. But in his stories, they were Bible stories where revenge led to redemption rather than further violence.
What was an example of one of those?
Well, the story of Joseph and his brothers. His brothers stripped him, threw him in a pit, left him for dead. He was sold into slavery. Then Joseph became a high minister in Egypt. And when he came face to face with his brothers again, he concealed his identity from his brothers and played with them a little bit. He got revenge on them. He didn't tell them that he was their brother, and he put them through some psychological torture, really. But in the end, rather than hurting them, and he couldn't hold back anymore, and he revealed himself to be the brother. And rather than killing his brothers, which might have been justified, he helped them, and he gave them food when they were hungry. But he wanted them to feel his pain. I mean, revenge itself is a psychological art. It takes staging and manipulation and imagination. And so he wanted to put them into sort of the weak place down in the pit as he had been, at least psychologically, for a while.
I understand when you were a child, you were involved in an elaborate act of revenge.
That must be me being the little sister and having a big brother. Well, yes, revenge, again, is sort of an expression of the weak toward the strong. In fact, in certain societies with honor codes during the medieval times, you could only get revenge on someone who was your equal or superior. That's why you were forbidden to take revenge against a woman, a slave, a person who's poorer than you are, or somebody who's asleep, because their defeat achieves no honor. They're considered weak. So I was the weak sister. My brother would stomp on me by day. By night, I had this great little revenge on him. I decided that I was tired of being tormented by him, and so I was going to steal all his underwear and keep it hidden until he was nice to me for at least 24 hours. It was one of these ideas. And so for a week, my brother wasn't nice to me, and he walked around in my father's baggy boxer shorts while everybody in the family was puzzling over what's the mystery of Hal's underwear, until finally my mother came across them in the attic, and there was no lesson learned there, but he did get his underwear back.
Your whole life is a series of great material for films, I think, as an adult, as a child as well. Laura Blumenfeld is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. We're talking about all kinds of revenge. Coming up, why people were so scared of Charles Mingus. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. My guest today is Laura Blumenfeld, the author of Revenge, A Story of Hope. And we're talking about the arts of revenge. The bassist and composer Charles Mingus was known to his enemies and to his friends as the angry man of jazz. Mingus even wrote music fueled by rage, and sometimes that vengeful impulse worked against him, sometimes it worked for him, as Simon Rentner discovered.
Charles Mingus's musicians called his jazz workshop the jazz sweatshop. Mingus would lash out at his musicians if they didn't play his music right. If he felt slighted by his players or fans, he would seek immediate retribution. Here is Gene Santoro, Mingus biographer and author of Myself When I'm Real.
People would come to see Mingus and his workshop perform live expecting something to happen, not just musical. His reputation was well enough established so that they would expect him to blow up or lecture the audience or lecture one of the people on the bandstand or maybe all three if they got really lucky that night. As Charles McPherson said to me, he wasn't happy even on a night when the music went perfectly. If he didn't get a chance to do one of his things on stage, it was like the performance was incomplete.
Alto saxophonist McPherson remembers when one of Mingus's most beloved musicians, Eric Dolphy, left the band.
I took Eric Dolphy's place because Eric had handed his 2 weeks' notice in. And Mingus was mad at it. He wanted to fight Eric. I mean, he wanted to actually beat Eric up because Eric was going to quit. And I can remember one at the end of one of the gigs, Mingus threatened him. He just, you know, you can't leave me. I'm all this music is hard. I got to teach it to somebody else. And you've been here, now you're gone, and now I got to start all over again. And you can't do it. I mean, he wanted to fight him. He wanted to cut him with a knife. And Eric is this very nice, calm man. And he told Mingus, he said, "Oh, Mingus, I don't have a knife." You know, and Mingus said, "Well, wait a minute. I'll go to the store over here and buy you one." He went over to the store, the little candy store, and bought him a knife and brought it back as if they're going to, like, you know, whittle on each other.
A week or so later, Mingus regretted his vicious attack. During a performance in Europe, Mingus renamed one of his compositions, "So Long, Eric." A few months later, Eric Dolphy died tragically in a diabetic coma. The day before the funeral, Mingus named his son Eric Dolphy Mingus. Occasionally, Mingus's anger was grounded in an unfair reality. Record companies continually cheated him from his royalty payments. In 1963, Mingus left a note for an Impulse record executive, stuck to the back of his chair with a knife. The note read, "Where the F is my money?" Signed Mingus in capital letters. His widow, Sue Mingus, preserves her husband's legacy and currently runs Revenge Records, a label devoted to the legitimate re-release of Mingus bootlegs. Sue declined to do an interview for this piece. She sees no relationship between the title of a record company and the character of her husband.
But no freedom for me.
Mingus's vengeance did more than win him his royalties and get him into fights. It reshaped American culture. Take the 1960 Newport Jazz Festival, for example. Mingus discovered promoter George Weem booked Benny Goodman and rock and roll acts above him for higher pay to draw in larger white audiences. In revolt, Mingus pulled his band from the lineup and created a counter festival for the exact same time within walking distance of Weem's. He had drummer Max Roach, vocalist Abby Lincoln, and saxophonist Ornette Coleman. Nobody came to Mingus's Rebel Festival, but Mingus got his way. Here's biographer Gene Santoro.
2 years later, when George restarted the Newport Jazz Festival, one of the headliners was a guy named Charles Mingus. As George said to me, Charlie knew how to get attention. This is a guy who found out at an early age in some ways that the best way to get people's attention was to get up in their faces. And it worked for him, so why change it?
In 1957, Mingus got in the face of Governor Orville E. Faubus of Arkansas. The Supreme Court had recently ordered schools desegregated. Governor Faubus called up the National Guard to prevent black students from attending Little Rock Central High School. Mingus aimed to make a foolery of Faubus.
Fables of Faubus, for example, where he does a satire of that whole sort of racist thing. You know, it's a very...
ridiculous, Danny.
Governor Faubus!
Why is he so sick and ridiculous?
He won't permit us in his school.
Then he's a fool.
Oh. It's funny. It sounds like something between circus music and vaudeville music, very much on purpose. It's aiming its rage in a way that uses Mingus's humor to undercut his target and make them seem as ridiculous as they should be, because in Mingus's eyes, that's what that stuff all was.
He would certainly be at odds. Politically, musically, relationship-wise, I mean, the fight is on. I mean, there was a lot going on. You had all the civil rights things. The war, the Vietnam War was happening. That was there, and Mingus had things to say about all of it. You know, Lester Young says you just have to fight for your life.
That is something that I think is part of that quality that attracts people to his music, that edge, that feel for life is something that you feel when you listen to the beauty of his music, the way that the melodies work. I mean, it's all stuff that's operating on you without having to be a musicologist or a musician. You just sense that, the joy in the music. And yet, at the same time, there's this affirmation of himself in there. This is what I am. Take it. Or leave it, understand it at the very least. And that's something that I think underlines Mingus's life and his art, both.
Mingus's psychologist wrote in the liner notes to The Black Saint and the Sinner Lady that Mingus is the black saint who suffers for his sins and those of mankind, a martyr. For most people in his life, Mingus's artistry transcended his behavior. The promoter George Wein came back to him in the end, as so many others did. They knew Mingus's music was bigger than all of them. For Studio 360, I'm Simon Rentner.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today, talking with the journalist Laura Blumenfeld. Laura, what do you think of somebody like Charles Mingus who incorporates revenge into his daily life? It's the way he apparently dealt with the world.
It's interesting. One of the things I looked at with revenge was the sense of interpretation, that people can undergo the same experience and yet interpret it differently. And some people don't want revenge because they think, well, this was just an accident. He seems to have taken things personally, though, everything or most things personally, like when the band member tried to leave. And this was a personal affront to him. It had nothing to do with maybe the band member's other plans in life. And revenge requires that feeling of me versus the world or us versus them, a kind of externalization of hate.
And obviously he lashed out in this kind of apparently instinctive, impulsive way. Are there people that you found in writing your book who really do plot coolly and calculatedly over years to seek their revenge when the victim or the aggressor, the former aggressor, at least expects it?
Yes, they do. Although very few people follow through on the revenge fantasies. That's why we love plays about revenge in movies, as you said, because we all, there's a point in every person's life, whether it's against a boss who treated you unfairly or a friend who betrayed you or that jerk who cut you off this morning and stole your parking spot. We dream of getting even, mostly.
Well, and just now between this film Changing Lanes and a movie that's called The Salton Sea are entirely about just incredibly florid, extravagant revenge fantasies. But maybe that's because, as you say, we Americans repress our revenge instincts, and we need to find it in the movies. But other cultures really don't. It's more of a central place in other cultures, isn't it?
Yes, it's not a taboo at all. In fact, it's encouraged and even expected. As long as you follow the rules, there are certain rules to revenge. I found, for example, in Albania, there's so much revenge, there's so many rules, they actually have a rule book. It's called the Kanun, and it was compiled in the 15th century by an Albanian nobleman. People keep it around their homes today. It's like the phone book lying dog-eared on top of the refrigerator. And you just figure out what precept applies to your particular grudge, and you're expected to follow through on it.
And it gets very specific?
Very specific. There are 168 different precepts which talk about every kind of violence which would trigger vengeance. They even had a rule for my father's wounding. It's the only place in the world I found kindred spirits who felt like, okay, here's what you do. Precept number 906, if I shoot a man and graze his head, this is the revenge that is expected.
Do you see your story and what you did and how it all came to resolution as a model for the world?
I see it. What I really hope is just that it'll be a story that'll offer some people companionship. First of all, that they should feel like their feelings of revenge are not unusual, that we all feel this, and don't worry if you do, even though everyone's told you you're supposed to have that socialized out of you by the time you're in sixth grade. And the second thing is I hope, especially in these very dark times after September 11th and with the violence in the Middle East, that people can just hold on to it like a little token to carry in their pockets to make them feel like maybe there is some hope.
Laura Blumenfeld, thank you for joining me today in Studio 360.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Laura Blumenfeld writes for The Washington Post. She's the author of the book Revenge, A Story of Hope. For more information about Laura and about any of the other stories you've heard on our program today, visit our website, studio360.org. To close our show today, we're taking you to the web, the official Ninja webpage. It's part spectacle, part performance, and in large part, adolescent. Every visitor asks the same question: can this possibly be for real? Ian Chillog tracked down the designer of RealUltimatePower.net.
Robert Hamburger created the official Ninja webpage in November 2001.
Hi, the site is all about ninjas, real ninjas. The site is awesome. My name is Robert, and I can't stop thinking about ninjas. These guys are cool, and by cool, I mean totally sweet. Facts. Number one, ninjas are mammals. Number two, ninjas fight all the time.
Look around. It's all like this. You get the sense it's been created by a 13-year-old who loves ninjas but knows nothing about them. There's these movie scripts that are really just one-scene adolescent fantasies. I'll quote, "The ninja star cuts the guy's head totally off. The head rolls over near this old dog that looks at the head and barfs all over the place, including the camera, which is awesome." There's chat rooms under the headings Ninjas versus Pirates and Ronald McDonald's Plot to Kill Ninjas. In Robert's world, ninjas are well endowed, they all play electric guitar, and they kill whoever they want. Robert is a method web designer. He tries to remember what it was like to be 13 and really excited about something. Out of that, he created a character, an adolescent boy also named Robert, and it is this character who creates the site.
We can just kind of see how this Robert character really doesn't know anything about ninjas, and he just develops like these facts about ninjas and like who they are, and it's just from there. I mean, you just kind of see everything that a young child thinks is sweet just personified infinitely in the ninja. I mean, these guys, they, nothing limits them. They don't even know what bedtime means. The power of the ninja is strong, fighting all creeps until they're all cold gone. Ninja, ninja, rap. Ninja, ninja, rap. Ninja, ninja, rap. Go, 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 go.
The site has become a phenomenon. A month ago in Los Angeles, there was a party in Robert's honor where everyone dressed up like ninjas. A movie studio sent ideas for a film starring Jack Black as Robert. And you can't imagine the emails he receives. Marriage proposals, offers of sex. A lot of people want to know if he's serious. Some people want revenge.
I have gotten quite a few from ninjutsu fanatics who are very disturbed by what I'm doing, and they said, I've studied ninjutsu for 20 years, and what you've done and what you're doing now is, you know, desecrating my art of killing people. And they get so mad at me, and they said, if I saw you on the street, I'd cut your throat. And it's a very violent reaction. And what do you expect? I mean, these guys, they're ninjas.
There's this dissonance between how ridiculous and out of control Robert the character is and the care the real Robert takes in creating him.
People think it's quite easy to write it, and I kind of have to set a mood for myself, you know, to write these, and it has to be the right time. And otherwise, it just sounds like you're forcing it, and then you just don't get the kid in there. You get some old guy trying to be like a kid. And what I'll do often is just, like, you know, pour myself a glass of pop, or... And then I'll run a warm bath for myself, and then I'll jump in butt first, and I'll splash myself in the face, and I'll flip out.
For Studio 360, this is Ian Chillar.
Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Michelle Siegel,
Lital Mulad,
Rob Weisberg,
Andy Lancet,
Gardner Allen,
Sarah Lilly,
Michael Rayfield.
The music is by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is a co-production of Public Radio International and WNYC New York, and is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Tiffany & Company Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
You definitely get the feeling like these subjects are signing to you through the decades of time that have gone past.
A filmmaker falls under the spell of decaying celluloid.
Even when this film deteriorates away, these dreams, these images continue.
I'm Kurt Anderson, Ephemeral Art. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.